This is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 47, and today I'm joined by Claire Colebrook, Edwin Earl Sparks Professor of English here at Penn State. Claire received her doctorate from the University of Edinburgh and was a professor of modern literary theory at the University of Edinburgh before joining the Faculty of English here at Penn State. Her work focuses on contemporary European philosophy, feminist theory, literary theory, contemporary music, dance, and visual culture, and political theory. Let me name just a few of her books to give you a sense of the range of her expertise. New Literary Histories from Manchester University Press in 1997, Ethics and Representation from Edinburgh Press in 1999, Understanding Deleuze from Allen and Unwin Press in 2003, Irony in the Work of Philosophy, Nebraska, 2002, and Milton, Evil, and Literary History and Continuum in 2008. She's currently working on two book projects, one on vitalism and another on William Blake and aesthetics, at least according to the website. But she joins me here on the Digital Dialogue today to discuss an article she published in the London Consortium in 2006 entitled Happiness, Death, and the Meaning of Life. And in fact, this article was recommended to me by a loyal listener to the Digital Dialogue, Dirk Fellman, who I'm giving a shout out to here. And he suggested that Claire would be a great guest on the Digital Dialogue. So, of course, I wanted to respond to Dirk's deep engagement with the work we're doing on the Digital Dialogue. And I immediately extended an invitation to Claire, who has graciously accepted to come on the Digital Dialogue. So, welcome to the Digital Dialogue.
Thanks for inviting me.
It's great to have you. So, I really enjoyed reading this essay, Happiness, Death, and the Meaning of Life, partly because it resonated with so much of the things that I've been thinking about with regard to Aristotle and narrativity and meaning, but also because of the work that I'm now starting to do with regard to Socrates and the way that he practices politics in the Platonic Dialogue. So maybe you could talk just briefly about what your main theme in the article was and some of the issues that arise.
Sure. I was actually trying to write a book about happiness, which started from, and this will become relevant, I ran an ultramarathon, and at the end of it, people were, which is 100 kilometres, so that's quite a lot.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, people were weeping, but there was tears of joy. So it led me to ask this question about the difference between happiness and pleasure, and why we do things that seemingly inflict pain upon ourselves. And then that led to questions about art as well, because why we would go to a cinema and cry, and subjection to violence and seeming unpleasure, but for the sake of a higher end. And that meant that I had to go back to Aristotle.
Right.
Because, well, for several reasons. Obviously, it's the first text that makes that distinction between happiness and pleasure. And then I think, and you'd know more about this than me, that it's become a common... Well, two things have become a commonplace. One is to say that this distinction that Aristotle had between happiness and pleasure is lost, that now we're pretty much in an era of hedonism, where we think of happiness as something that you can, well, get from taking ecstasy, for example, that it's an immediate pleasure, and it doesn't have anything to do with... unpleasure.
Right.
And yet, so that's the first assumption, is that we've shifted quite significantly from Aristotle's understanding, which I think I disagree with, because things like watching a very sad movie or taking part in an ultramarathon or doing anything that's a short-term unpleasure seems to give us some sense of reward, and that we would say that that's part of a happy life. And when we say, I'm happy in my job or I'm happily married, we don't mean it's pleasurable. We mean it's somehow something we would choose.
Right. And to use the language that you use in the essay, there's a question of meaning and the depth of meaning.
Yeah, and that's something that I both agree with and think that we ought to be more critical of.
Okay.
So it seemed to me when I was looking into the topic that there were... There's loads of work on Aristotle and happiness, and pretty much everyone agrees that there's something valuable to making a distinction between happiness and pleasure. precisely because of the very nature of human life as having a capacity to sacrifice pleasure, or, which I guess would be the easiest definition, would be something like bodily sensations or appetites, for the sake of something that we choose that we deem to be more than, better than, or different from.
Right.
And that's where the difficulty comes, it seems to me, that we know that happiness is more than, different from, distinct from, not like animal happiness, not like immediate pleasure, and yet then what that added thing is becomes the more difficult part of the problem. And I think one of the ways it's solved, and I'm not satisfied with that, is making this mythic appeal to the Greek happiness. Oh, the Greeks had this notion of community and social understanding and a much more rich interpretation of human life that we've lost.
Right.
So that by creating that notion that there once was this notion of human life in which we would act for the sake of, say, honour or civic virtue, that we've now lost.
Well, but I mean, I think one of the things I think that you, in fact, point out in the essay is that there's something deeply human about a sense for the fact that life has sense, or that there seems to be a sense to life. Now, and the need for sort of humans to come to some terms with that in terms of making meaning out of
Definitely. And then it becomes, I think that's absolutely true, and I think it's lamentable that now, because of things like animal studies and animal rights, and which are legitimate in their own way, at least in my area of philosophy and certainly in English studies, the idea of saying something is deeply human or something is intrinsically human is deemed to be either naive or problematic or politically unacceptable because you're, you know, speciesism and things like this.
Right.
But I think it doesn't, just because you acknowledge a distinction in kind that isn't just a distinction in degree, doesn't mean you deprive other beings of rights or legitimacy.
Right.
It's just to say one has to look at the different ways in which various forms of life flourish, if we want to use that word.
I wonder if there's, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about this because in this book on Aristotle, I've been trying to, I was trying to sort of articulate a conception of truth that was on the one hand human, but also there was a continuity between a certain capacity to articulate things and the kinds of ways that non-human animals interact with their environment in meaningful ways. And so, you know, I think even there's a way in which even in Aristotle to delineate the continuity between the animal world and the human world with regard to logos and
definitely. So then you would want to say that it's true that humans have meaning, but that they're not the only animals that have meaning.
Exactly.
And then I would say that you, if you define meaning as some way of connecting some sequences through time, so that if you have a dog that happens to choose running towards its master rather than some other person, that's because it's meaningful. It's recognised something that's the same through time that it will choose that doesn't just have to do with the dog, where the dog is going to be fed, and that's why animals are capable of sacrifice and affection and so on. And then I would say, but the difference with human meaning, and this is where I think art is important, is it's a difference, it's not a difference in degree, it's a difference in kind, that because of the fact that things like art take on a separate or autonomous structure that exists through time independent of the humans that make them. Means two things. You have more complex forms of meaning so that we can keep reading the works of Aristotle and misread them and they can mutate and they can act against their original intent. You know, they can become distorted, lost, fragmented, copied, mutate in ways that biological meaning wouldn't, the way animal meaning, because it doesn't have an archive that can carry through time until dogs develop some form of memory storage system outside their bodies, they're not going to have the same sorts of meaning that we do.
No, and I think that's right. But I also think, every time I want to insist upon continuity, I think we need to remind ourselves of difference and qualitative and difference. But there is a way in which sort of the way genetics in a certain sense operates is not unlike the way in which story is carried on, the narrative, let's say, the way in which we engage a text like Aristotelian text is engaged, mutated, develops, and returns in certain kinds of ways. Now, I want to, again, affirm that there's important differences that we don't want to elide, but...
I would say this. There's a point at which a difference in degree becomes a difference in kind, and when it reaches that threshold, everything changes.
Mm-hmm.
So that even if you look at animals and plants and other natural living systems as even having some basic sort of writing system or, you know, a proto-form of language, I think the crucial difference that one would want to draw from human examples, and I want to fetishize art, but the point is it has its own system of evolution. And that's why, and this is why, if I would go back to the ultra marathon example, because you can consider that as a type of art. It's something that was a system that develops its own rules. It then takes on an autonomy in its own right that starts to have a very punishing effect on human bodies and human psyches, and this is the crucial thing where I think art brings this more to the point. It's opaque to the humans that generate it, so that you could say that meaning begins by us trying to make sense of our lives and manage it through time and have a rich and fulfilled life, and that we could say we choose things like a meaningful job or a meaningful marriage or a meaningful charity work because we think that it will enrich our lives in a fuller sense. But then I also think one has to pay attention to committing to those sorts of structures that then start to diminish our lives as well in ways that it's in ways that we can't fully understand. And I think this is particularly important now as we're having forms of art that are even more technically sophisticated than they used to be. That they're the idea that humans can completely comprehend and master the works that they produce. It's over if it was ever there.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it is that idea. I think is rooted in a certain kind of, and I would identify it with a kind of emergence of modern philosophical subjectivity and the idea that we sort of have, we are creators, we are in control, sort of in a certain kind of way of the world, and have in a certain way create the world, make the world. And I think what's remarkable about reading Aristotle, reading Plato, I think Plato had a powerful understanding of this, and the fact that he chose to do philosophy through art, namely by writing dialogues, really allows us to think about this issue in a really important way. Because one might say that for many, many centuries, the whole question of what Plato's intention was with writing this or that dialogue was a pretty important sort of idea, a hermeneutical idea.
Sure.
And the fact that now that we can look at these texts and say, well, on the one hand, whether Plato intended this or that is not really the issue. These things appear in the text.
Yeah. Well, what we have is what's left over. Any intention is produced from that.
Exactly.
That's all we have.
Right.
And intention is projected intention. And works operate in ways that seem to be at odds with some of their intentions.
Right.
And I think, that's true in any form of writing.
Yeah.
The one thing I'd say about a more sophisticated reading of philosophy would bring this, is that literary texts, just to take a different form of text, because there's also visual texts and cinematic texts, there's also a tradition within literature of reflecting upon how texts are opaque or aren't understood.
Right.
So that there's a huge body of literature that's about non-understanding And the second, and maybe this would make it more clear, is if we say, well, humans make sense of their lives by using narrative, and that seems to be a positive thing, that seems to expand and enrich our lives, I think there's a literary, well, I don't think, I think it's uncontestable, there's a literary tradition that says the narratives we use to make sense of our lives don't necessarily enrich or illuminate our lives, but can also pacify us, you know, preclude us from asking difficult questions. And I don't want to be some sort of Marxist who says literature is some sort of opiate of the people that stops you from thinking, because that's not clearly not the case. But every literary text is double for the sense it makes of your life.
Right.
It also gives it a form that precludes certain types of questions. And I think that's particularly important in the 21st century because we've got old narratives.
Right.
And old literary forms, and old models of understanding narrative and literary form that aren't going to survive into the 21st century.
Well, and I think that's one of the things, that's actually in some ways, maybe without having realized it, when I started thinking about this digital dialogue project and also all the ways in which I myself am trying to use digital media too, in some ways... there's a narrative dimension to this, but I feel like this is a sort of a way of performing a philosophical life, which is, I think, you know, I hope much more rich than a caricature of philosophy that says, well, philosophy is about concepts, that it's about clarity, it's about rationality, it's about logical arguments. And I think philosophy needs to be, and has from its beginning really been, about deeply rooted in literature and narrative in that kind of artistic.
Yeah, narrative. And that's why I think whenever I, on the one hand, I always want to appeal to Aristotle because all our understanding is somewhat indebted to that, but there's a, and you would know this more than me, there's a naive and nostalgic fetishization of there was once this notion of philosophy as community in which everyone had rational discussion, and there, you know, and this is this whole Greek conception of the Greeks were narrative animals. You know, they made sense of their lives. They weren't enslaved to television and pop culture, and they didn't have fragmented attention spans. And there's all this lamentable stuff about the internet is changing our brains. Yeah, we no longer have syntax, and that's true. Actually, we have different forms of attention. We have different, and instead of saying, oh, this is lamentable, and we need to go back to some Aristotelian understanding of the polis and community. Just, it's over.
Well, I mean, and the thing that I continually bring up in this context is, look, I mean, think about Plato and the decision to write. I mean, the technology for the Greeks was writing, was the emergence from the oral tradition, which had all these great things. You had to remember. You could remember the entirety of the Iliad. The other people could repeat these things. And then writing comes, and you have... Plato staged this discussion in the Phaedrus, for example, with Socrates, and saying, you know, staging this discussion between Tois and Thaumas and the myth in which, you know, there's a real concern about what writing is doing to us.
Yes, and that's always been it. There's always technophobia.
Right, exactly.
And before writing, there's memory systems, and the minute the Odyssey and the Iliad become remembered forms, they mutate, they have their own... forms of mutation, and, you know, copying, remembering, slips of the, you know, the fact that words sound the same mean that they'll get substituted. And that's, so it's there's always been the structures that humans use to make meaning of their lives are never fully their own.
Right.
Because they always have some structure, whether it's a memory structure or a writing structure or an internet structure. And then I guess the interesting question, which why the evolutionary metaphor is helpful, is because sometimes I think the formal structures of narrative and memory lag behind the use that we need to make of narrative. So that I would say particularly now when we're facing different timescales, like in the 21st century, we're not... Our narrative models tend to be about human generations. Most of our narratives are still about families and small communities. And you look at the popular... literature now, I guess, things like Jonathan Franzen. Now, it's great Aristotelian narrative. He's writing a story about a family, making, you know, an American community, what it is to make a life and become an individual in the 20th century. But he's using a really 19th century novel form to do that.
Right.
And the fact that he's so popular indicates that we're almost pacifying ourselves with familial narratives and personal narratives when the sorts of information systems we have, like the internet, but any other forms of digital media that have memory systems that far exceed a single human, means that we do need different forms of narrative.
So what might some of those look like?
Well, this is why I would say, and I don't want to substitute one form of 19th century nostalgia for early 20th century nostalgia, but you, okay, you look at, to go outside literature, you look at some of the multimedia art installations that take place, which directly reflect upon the limited nature of the human attention span, and that there are systems, and let's face it, there are narratives that no single human can understand, like the current economic crisis and political systems can't be narrated in the traditional forms, and yet when you listen to the media, no matter what side it's on, they're still using human-human conflicts, you know, with good and evil and individuals. But then I think even if you looked into pop culture, it's almost ahead, and I don't want to be naively celebratory of pop culture, it's almost ahead of some philosophical and high art discussions that even standard disaster epics, but also these, you know, long-winded, strange narrative television miniseries from Lost to The Wire and things like that, but even sort of failed films like Inception or Adjustment Bureau start to lose the sense of individual actors being in command of a series of events in which good triumphs over evil. I mean, they're multivalent narratives, I guess, is what. I think the public's beginning to be able to consume different types of narrative, and there's almost a narrative war going on between people who want to look back to something like a Jonathan Franzen familial dialogue and then and other writers that they're no less popular, but they don't have the standard individualist or familial forms of narrative.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem that there's so much interesting there. I mean, there's a way. Let me put it this way: there's a way in which, when you really try, as I've been trying to do, to participate in using digital media to really sort of do academic work, but also put meaning to my own life as a father, as a as an associate dean, as all these things, and try to think about how and think in a thoughtful way, I hope, and also self-critical way of how I'm curating things in a certain way and presenting myself in this form, and thinking very consciously about doing that. I recognize that on the one hand, it's very much of a old model sort of construction of self in a way, but if you but I've been trying to do it in a way that is actually responsive to what others are doing in a way that opens up this enormous space of difference and multiplicity of meaning, and that you really, you know, you can walk into the Petit Library or the Paterno Library and see all the books on the shelves, and that feels some one way. But when you begin to click links and see just this, all of this enormous,
it's true that it's. But the minute you put an old model into a new technology, like the minute you start having a philosophical blogosphere, the medium changes. The message. And the main thing is, you can see the transformation of something like Wikipedia, which, you know, 10 years ago, if a student quoted Wikipedia, you were crossed it out, this is unreliable, it was lamentable, and now nothing could be more vibrant. And when I'm asked to write an encyclopedia article, which I can't believe I still accepted to do, it just felt completely redundant because I knew that that model, and the fact that Wikipedia is intrinsically unreliable because it's multi-authored is also means it's intrinsically rich as well. And that's why everything that's, you know, always been technology is always, it's a pharmacon, as Derrida says about Plato. It extends, but the degree to which it extends knowledge, it means it alienates knowledge. And again, to go back to, and I think that's the same, why one has to be wary of narrative models, because without some sort of aesthetic, and it's really important that it's aesthetic, because we we become captivated by the stories we tell about our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, not just individual lives, but nationalism and all the things that we do that are noble.
Right.
All the things that we do that are saintly.
That we want to tell ourselves.
And it's true, yes. It's true that if we have a sense of higher worth or the individual I might become, it's a very good thing because we're made better. Right. It can also seduce us.
Yeah.
And that's, and I think, one of the, you know, reasons why I was somewhat critical of all the work on Aristotle and narrative, yes, it's good as an antidote to human lives aren't just about consumption and immediate pleasure and so forth. But there's also a sense in which one shouldn't simply be enslaved to, and a narrative is an intrinsically good thing.
Right.
Just as no technology is intrinsically good or evil.
Right.
And each comes with it extends and it alienates at the same time.
So, I mean, you've been speaking a little bit about narrative models, and I wonder what, and maybe this is too dichotomous a way of thinking about it, but if we, let's say, are critical of narrative models, is there something that performs that role, or does that role even need to be performed, having a model, you know, that fits into, that gives us a kind of structure of meaning and allows us to...
I would say, and this is something I wouldn't want to bet my life on, but, you know, I'm beginning to think that you have a type of narrative model that begins, and, you know, it's a commonplace in literary criticism to say the novel begins with capitalism, which is an individual faces a world of adversity, which is played out in two models, fortune and love, and that has to be resolved by the end. Mm-hmm. And then you have 200-300 years of complicating that. But if you still go to blockbuster cinema or you read something like a Jonathan Franzen novel, it still has that same... It gets more and more complicated, but most plots are about triumph over adversity, so you have a good and evil binary, and some form of romance plot as resolution, which has this promise of a next generation. Now, modernist literature complicates that. It takes that as its model and looks at it as seductive. But I think that narrative model survives, and that's I think that's a problem.
Right.
There are other, you're saying there are other narrative models, and I would say they're in new media.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so that's why I think, you know, there's a big difference between an episode of Law and Order, which has problem resolution, good, evil, you know, and something like Lost, The Wire, and a whole series that seem to, I mean, in the end, they do provide narrative resolution in the end, but they also start to frustrate that. And it took, you know, six series of some of these things.
Right. So so you've been focusing on the structure of narrative, right?
Yeah.
This need for resolution, or, you know, the withholding of it to reveal some other things. But I'm also beginning to think now more about the whole question of authorship and author and the structure of identity and authorship that goes along with a lot of this kind of notion of narrative, namely that one of the things that's powerful about Wikipedia is powerful about, like, for example, when I use blogs in my classroom to co-author a document and watch the tag cloud organically grow around what the students are interested in as well as what I'm interested in, then you begin to think about, well, wait a minute, who owns this course? Who owns
that's
this document?
Interesting.
You know,
it's
not mine, but it is mine. I'm empowering it in a certain way. They're involved in it in a different way. And so then authorship becomes different. And, of course, then if authorship comes into question like that, it has all kinds of...
You don't have a single... That's really interesting because just as you're saying that, I'm thinking, you know, before the novel, you know, let's say you take the dominant either Shakespearean drama, in which case you have multiple authors, and so there are some bits and pieces that just don't seem to fit in or don't make sense that we're stuck with them and we have to do something with them. But even if you look at something like Milton's Paradise Lost, he's inheriting basically a whole series of fragments. It's like he's already had a storyboard and loads of screenwriters and he's somehow got... He's handed a deck of cards that he's got to deal with.
And think about Homer too. I mean, Homer's
exactly.
The same
Any,
model, right?
So what you could almost say, which I was just thinking about as you were talking, is that you have a single author novelistic form emerge very late in human history. It's like, hundreds of years old. And actually that's become the dominant when really things like platonic dialogues as well, multiple voices, you can't really master it. There's not, you know, and fragments, bits and pieces, interventions, copying errors, corruptions from interested parties over the years. And so that if you... The if you looked at then the models that are now reappearing,
right,
that they're probably more like the history of human narrative,
yeah,
than the novel was.
Right.
But I would say that then what's interesting is that if you look at the way non-fiction makes sense of the world,
mm-hmm,
that's still in, I would say that's still enslaved to a novelistic imagination. So
mm-hmm,
if you look at,
yeah,
the way people responded to the financial crisis,
right,
it's who was really, you know, it was the idea to find a villain, and there was,
right,
like, within,
sure,
a month of it happening, there were five or six books,
right,
trying to attribute,
right,
a face to evil.
Right.
And that's the same with, you know, why you had to have a Saddam Hussein or an Obama.
Right.
It's as though our non-fiction imagination is completely enslaved to an 18th century novel.
Well, and it's very interesting to watch what's happening in journalism and what's happening even with events like the earthquake and the tsunami in Japan. I mean, because of things like Twitter, because of things like Facebook,
mm,
even in the political issues in the Middle East now, I mean, you're beginning to see a kind of collaborative, and a collaborative might not be. I mean, it's all these people sort of putting words to things.
Yeah.
And they can be, I think, curated in such a way that we can sort of see, get a vision of what's going on. I'm thinking about some of the ways that Andrew Karp and in NPR is using Twitter to curate news. Basically, he does, you know, really tricky things, like when something like the tsunami happens in Japan, he'll start searching on Twitter for people who are saying things like, "What was that? Did you feel that?"
Yeah, so it's noise. Right.
And then he begins to drill down to them and,
mm-hmm,
and he brings them out and try to get,
yeah,
some. So, and then, I mean, so there's a way in which that there's a kind of journalistic authoring going on there, but it's much more dynamic and collaborative.
And it's multivalent, you know, and,
yeah,
it's, and there's not a single causality.
Right.
And you think by the time it filters into the evening news on Fox, CNN, where you've got to have an interview,
right,
and an opinion piece, it's as though...
And an expert.
Right. And I don't know about you, but my students don't watch that anymore.
No. I mean,
it's as though there's almost two different neural architectures. There's
amazing.
One narrative model where we want who's yes or no,
yeah,
good or... And, you know, and I would put, like, Fox, MSNBC and CNN exactly the same,
yeah,
in terms of the structure. The content,
yeah,
might change.
Right.
But to attribute a single cause to a person and then have, you know, and how can we fix this?
Right. Well, I mean, I'm struck by that because I'm so now, have become so ensconced in all, you know, in all these different news feeds and again,
mm,
all my news through, you know, my Google Reader or through Twitter,
uh-huh,
following,
yeah,
people on Twitter and all. And I barely ever watch, you know, those things on TV until I get into a hotel room and I'm bored,
yeah,
and I turn it on and I'm just struck by exactly what you're saying.
It's a face.
How impoverished is this, though?
Yeah. And
it is a face, yeah. It's a face, and it's also very top-down. It's very,
yeah,
you're passive, you're receiving, it's saying.
And that would be okay if that were a dying form of media being overtaken by a new generation, because that's what happens.
Right.
But I think the problem is that when people start thinking about elections and policy,
yeah,
and decisions, and this is where it goes back to, you know, what it means to be a citizen,
right,
which is what the whole discussion of narrative and a life is, how I understand myself, what it is to be a political individual.
Right.
The problem is that the, let's call it the CNN model,
mm-hmm,
a face, two sides,
yeah,
how it gets resolved,
right,
you know, moral binary, and also a certain temporality, which is we can compare this oil disaster to a previous oil disaster.
Right.
We can compare this economic collapse. Where it's not. These structures are entirely different.
Right.
It's not just the information structures that are different.
Right.
The
right.
event is different.
Yeah.
And I think the problem is that those narrative, even though it's not the dominant narrative model of consumption,
right,
like that, you're right. I think
right.
no one's the generation that's going to be taking over isn't enslaved to that model anymore. But
right.
the generation that's making decisions,
mm-hmm,
not just about policy, but the parameters of what counts as policy.
Well, I mean, I'm feeling that in an enormous way on an institutional level here. I mean, at Penn State and in the academy, what do we do when, let's just take the issue of identity and authorship.
Mm.
I mean, okay, well, what do we do when this text that's been created is not wholly yours, that we cannot give this one person tenure because of
exactly.
this set of things that
yeah.
she or he has produced? So it really is cutting to the core of institutional structures that I don't think we're ready. We know exactly how to deal.
And how can we ask students to write individually authored essays, right, which is like a really 18th century model, when every bit of production that's now taking place in the world is probably not going to take that.
And they're going to be entering the job world. Let's forget if they go into academia or not, and they enter the job world where they're going to be expected to participate in this kind of a way of making meaning. And I do think there's a way, there's a deep way in which it's making meaning. It's narrative in a different kind of way.
Yeah, and I think that's why you need a richer, just as you know, we started out by saying animals have, you know, meaning doesn't mean a formal language.
Right.
Meaning is some structure that connects a perception to another perception and create some form of decision-making pattern.
Mm.
And then that means that meaning doesn't have to have individual authorship.
Well, and that's why I've been returning to vocabulary about cultivating, more organic vocabulary, because on the one hand it feels like this is something that can be grown or cultivated or nourished in a certain way, but it's not. But doing that recognizes that you don't really have full control.
Yeah, my language would be less organicist and more viral. Because I think one of the problems is, and you know, this is probably more from someone in a literary tradition, that the default aesthetic and the default model of narrative is always organicist, which is something that grows and flourishes and maintains itself, and actually, there's something positively self-destructive in the way art mutates, that it might be the case that our reading of Shakespeare or Milton or Spencer or Henry James bears no real fidelity to the original model, and that's okay. That's fine. You know, I'm not one of these people that when a film is made of a text, you know, walks out heartbroken because it's not like the book, then why would you make a film?
right. Well, I mean, so there's two things, and the core issue I would like to return to, which, because at the end of the essay on happiness and death, you really articulate something powerful about Derrida that I would, and the emphasis on singularity, on what you're saying now is viral as opposed to my
organicist.
Approach, which, you know, I want to think about that in a little bit. So maybe we could return to that, because the other issue was the question of, how we respond to this kind of disorder that results from, this polysemic way of, or let's say the appearing of this, you know, multiple meanings that we can't really get our heads around. And in some ways, I think, you know, first of all, as a philosophy professor, but then also now as an associate dean in liberal arts, and thinking about, well, how are we educating students to respond effectively to this when we ourselves, as faculty, as administrators, as teachers, as adults, are still learning this along with them.
Yeah. I think the real challenge is that there's an argument in Derrida, let's say all writing is viral, in that the condition for me to put something into a text that's going to survive is that it takes on a form that's outside me. So it's essentially alien. And, you know, people misread Derrida and say, well, he says there's no meaning, or he says that everything, you know, there's no stability. It's on the contrary. Actually, there's quite a degree of stability. It's just that it's not it can't be grounded in intention. It has a certain autonomy to function on its own. And I think the challenge is that's the essential nature of memory, is that it has to, in order for something to be remembered, it has to take on a repeatable form. But the minute it takes on a repeatable form, it's not the event itself. And so that if I have memories and they're going to recur through time, they start to have, and everyone knows this, you know, you don't have to believe in repressed memories syndrome. It's just memories take on a repeatable form and they'll mutate. And That includes writing systems and it includes technical systems. Mm-hmm. And I then think the challenge is for us not to then simply dismiss the new forms of writing system we have, because mm-hmm. Let's say we take some of the stupid responses to the internet and these new systems and say, well, of course, every time there's a new technology, everyone becomes a Luddite, right. And there were the same anxieties about mass publication of literature as there now about the internet.
Right.
And that's true. Mm-hmm. So you could say, of course, there's something alien about technologies of writing as such.
Right.
And then I think the more difficult question is, without being nostalgic or utopian, mm-hmm. is the particular writing structures that we have. And this gets back to your question of what you do as a liberal arts professor. And I think the worst thing you can do is if you look at the debates over the humanities at the moment. And there's there's an attempt to cut, destroy, mm-hmm. you know, in the face of economic imperatives.
Right.
I guess that's the rationale.
Right.
And I think the worst thing one can do is talk about a language of survival. We have to keep, there's something intrinsically worthy. Yes. And the only way one survives is to say, actually, maybe the model we have of the humanities, which is critical, reflexive, sophisticated reading and self and the cultivation of what a good critical individual,
mm-hmm.
that has to go.
Yeah.
And so I think the big challenge is to think about the model of the human that subtends the humanities.
Right.
And that means having a different understanding of what it is to be a sense-making individual. Mm-hmm. And that probably goes to, what it is to be a student is probably not to produce 10 individual pieces of work a year, but to become good at collaboration and criticism, and to get rid of the notion of the production of texts and talk about the production of collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've placed far too little emphasis on what dialogue.
Yeah, right.
It's as though we give, I don't know about, but it's we give 10% or something to class participation.
Right.
And that's basically so that students turn up. But that really means we're not putting our money where our mouth is and saying, what, do we mean that going to university means producing 10 texts? We could have just... We could have had distance education.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, especially when I take you to be, when you speak about writing and you speak about text, I mean, with the meaning of what a text is now is really diverse. I mean, we can talk about video production as a kind of project that would be a text for students. I'm teaching students how to, and learning ourselves how to read those videos and audio files. And so writing is not just writing. Writing is really much more dynamic.
And that everyone knows that infects the heart of academia, that there's a star system and a market and commodification and buzzwords and buzz topics that get around. So it's already the notion of mass media has already infiltrated.
Yeah.
And to try and say one needs to preserve the notion of the humanities as a sphere of, critical reflection and engagement on the great tradition of texts, it seems to me we're shooting ourselves in the foot, because what we can offer is not a body of knowledge, but what we can offer is more sophisticated models of engagement.
Well, and I keep returning to, and then you're sort of helping me sort of think about why I have sort of intuitively gone to this, but not only because I've been studying Aristotle for too long, probably, but I'm constantly returning not so much to those nostalgic notions of reading but more to the question of virtues and habits and cultivating abilities. Let me put it in those terms. What abilities are we? Are we cultivating in ourselves and in our students the ability to respond to this kind of diversity of meaning, to engage with one another in productive rather than in impoverishing ways? And a liberal arts education, I think, historically always has been about cultivating certain excellences, certain abilities. Mm. And, if we can think about what are those abilities we need to cultivate in one another to respond effectively.
And that means changing the notion, which I guess you said, of a text.
Yeah.
They need to see that, a 2008 election is a highly sophisticated, very well-produced, multi-authored text.
Right. Right,
and they need to see the same about a blockbuster movie, that it's a highly sophisticated, rhetorically reflexive visual text. Right.
And how many of our courses can we say are that? I mean, the problem with the way we structure courses...
It's a struggle.
...is that, you know, we are... It's still this very much sort of top-down model of, you know, you're going to read this, 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 and this. You're going to produce this, 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 and this for me as the expert.
Yeah.
And, you know... Are we producing courses that are texts in this lively way?
And that's, I mean, one of the, I don't know if this is straying too far from the point, but I think with things like e-education, my experience has been that it's seen to be taking the classroom model and extending it in an impoverished form, which would be then the model of, well, Wikipedia is like a second-rate encyclopedia because we haven't got a professor to write the article, so we have to get 10 amateurs to write it.
Right.
When actually it should be the other way round, that now that there's e-models of learning, we don't have to be enslaved to 1 hour in a classroom where we've all read the text the 3 days before. Right. And I think that there's, particularly if you look at something like... Penn State, that's not in a city university.
Right.
It now completely doesn't matter where you're located, and that therefore the model of what it is to learn and read and make sense of something just has to move away from the bounded text, which is again why I object to organicist models of like the work.
Right. But I mean, maybe we could think a little bit, because this going to the crux of my sort of you're getting at the heart of my vocabulary with this, you know, the critique of organicism, which I completely see the reason for it, and you know, and maybe it in part is this sort of presumption of a whole, a certain kind of, you know, or integrity, coherence that is, but isn't. Couldn't we, you know, conceptualize the organic, as in fact I think you do with using Derrida in this essay, as bound up with death, as bound up with the alienation, as bound up with disintegration? I mean, isn't that still...
But there's death and there's death.
Okay.
Because I think that's... If you look at the model of death that's been crucial in formulating narrative, it's that there's... You know, a narrative begins with a disturbance or a disruption and then has to reach some point of equilibrium again.
Right.
So it has to be the elimination of desire, which is a model of arriving at its own end.
Right.
And we don't want the narrative to end 30 seconds into the film or 50 seconds into the... or 50 pages into the novel. It has to unfold in its own way. And I think one of the things that's most fascinating about narrative is acceptable and unacceptable ends, so that we know when you go to see a film, like a really badly formed film like Avatar, you can see what possible ends there are. You know that the blue people aren't going to be exterminated and the world isn't... And so I think there's some... seductive and pacifying lure in organic narratives in which we are captivated by something that grows, that flourishes, and then comes to its own conclusion with an end, and in which, you know, if you take the model of the film, you know that certain characters can or can't die.
Right.
You know, there's a certain amount of loss that certain things can and can't happen. And that's not just an aesthetic problem. I think that's a problem of making sense of the events in this world. And there's a different type of death, which is not organic death, but, you know, the phrase that's not Derrida's, but comes more from someone like Adorno, is that art's a priori deadness, which is to say these objects circulate. And they're not living structures. You know, every art object's a dead letter or a fragment of a past that we can never really fully animate. And it just repeats and recurs and we can never make sense of it. And, I mean, one has to say, why do we keep on? You know, there's a sort of strange repetition. Why do we keep on reading these? Like, why are we still reading Plato? Right. Yes, there's a sense in which you're right. It helps us understand. But there's something that's just not going to go away. That's not going to go away. And that's, but, you know, that if you were really wanted an efficient form of human communication, there'd just be bits of the corpus of the archive that you'd get rid of. But they're there, and they just keep coming back. And who knows how they got there?
Yeah.
You know. So.
But I mean, that's there's the Well, okay, so there's a lot there that, you know, the presumption of sort of, you know, we would get rid of certain parts of the corpus, or we're trying to fit this corpus into this systematic totality that makes, you know, sense. I think that as a hermeneutical strategy is one that's highly problematic. Obviously, it has dominated, I think, philosophy for many centuries.
Get what Kant really wanted to say and get rid of this, you know, this passage.
This
he kind of really wanted to
but
say.
But, I mean, what would it be to take that... all of the ways in which a thinker's thinking doesn't cohere, and all of the ways, and particularly pointing, and from my perspective, these are the moments in any great philosophical thinking to think about, namely those moments where there's a change in meaning, or there is an inconsistency, or there really is a problem that doesn't resolve itself. Those are the moments in philosophical thinkers that are the ones that are most philosophically interesting, not because you want to resolve them, but because they show something.
Yeah, and you know that when you teach a text, you don't hone in on the sentence that everyone understands,
right.
but it's the one that you just that's completely almost completely opaque. I mean, I think, you know, there's it's a problematic word, but Paul DeMann, who was a more sort of hard line on this topic than Derrida, really. I think Derrida got sort of seduced by being taught by literature departments. But DeMann kept using the word materiality for it's true that we keep on thinking of texts as somehow indicating something about life. But really what we're left with is just the text.
Right.
And there's something very machinic and inhuman and technical and I would say dead about it.
Yeah.
The fact that it is dead means we're going to have to keep on, you know, that's why we can keep on reading it.
Mm-hmm.
If it were fully alive, if it were fully organic, it could be assimilated, you know, rendered part of some ongoing communicative whole, you know. And I think... I would say the problem, I really have a problem with organicism, because if you look at all the rhetoric about, you know, the globe, globalism, Gaia, ecology, you know, it's again, it's a pacifying lure. You know, that's not the universe we're in. We're living in a universe of not just one single death, but, but you know, multiple consistent and infinite deaths.
Right.
And all we have is wreckage. And I'm not saying that in a bleak way. It's that we just have fragments and bits and pieces.
Right.
And, you know, global narratives, organic narratives, preclude us from confronting, you know, what DeMann referred to as materiality.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it just, it's there.
Right. So, I mean, see, any response I'm going to have to that is going to move away from their it's there, it's their moment.
And, of course, any response you do has to move away from that. You can't just say, okay, you know, any reading I have of Wordsworth or Aristotle is a reading and I've projected some sense.
Right.
I've animated, I've brought it to life.
Right.
When really, I mean, the classic example would be when you're teaching Wuthering Heights and you'll have a student say, do you think Heathcliff really loved Cathy? Or do you think they really got... And you're like, no, what you had is the text.
Right.
And if it's it's indeterminate.
Yeah, right.
Now, you're right. Any response is going to recuperate
that. But I guess that's part of my point is that there are responses. We do respond.
Exactly.
We take those inert things as invitations to
say something else. What else could we do?
Right.
But we can't be completely seduced by that. That's my argument would be recognize that everything we have, from the works of Aristotle to every multimedia production that comes out, you know, including Jersey Shore, it has a life of its own that one can never fully assimilate.
Right.
And I think that the then you have a sense of human. Yes, let's say we go back to human beings as sense-making animals,
right.
But their production of sense has to include a load of stuff that's senseless.
Right. Well, I wanted to. So I have this quotation from a part of your essay. It's on page 12 for those of you who can find the essay. We'll post it on the blog. It says you have this passage where it says. So why does Derrida so perversely concentrate on the unsuccessful, infelicitous, or unhappy act? Partly because he is rigorously considering how language is possible, and one can only speak act or take part in a context if one's act is already not fully one's own, but potentially quotable, alienable, and repeatable beyond its effective potential. And I think this speaks to exactly
I'd still agree with that. Yeah, yeah. That's one of the few things I'd still author again.
Okay. Well, but I mean, and I think from my perspective, the question in part is one of emphasis. Mm-hmm. Because when I speak of organicism or when I speak of cultivating and of meaning and of connection and relation and the possibilities of that, I also want to always affirm what I would call unicity or irreducible singularity that always, to use an Adornoian concept, that always has a remainder that we can't get at.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's always something that remains
absolutely
elusive. Right. So if we forget the elusiveness of it, that's a real problem.
Yeah.
But if we overemphasize the inert and the elusive, then I think that has its own set of problems.
Exactly. And that's why if you go back to technology as a pharmacon, it's as naive to celebrate Wikipedia and the internet as producing this global community of interconnected. And the same applies to these Twitter and Facebook.
Sure.
Because every new media that creates a relation then also has to create a system that's intrinsically, necessarily, and unavoidably alien.
Right.
Yeah, and that's why, rather than have a narrative of good or evil about various forms of technology, you have to negotiate the particular forms of poison and cure that they create.
Right. Yeah, and I think that from my perspective, one of the things that I'm increasingly aware of is that to diagnose the poisons and the cures, you have to be involved with these media. You can't be sitting on the sideline and just sort of pronouncing that this is, you know.
And that's what I would say the problem with. Yeah, when philosophers have looked at narrative, they've had a very nostalgic Aristotelian, and it's almost as though the 20th century in narrative never happened.
Right.
When they say narrative is a way of making sense of life as a whole, you think, did they read anything after Jane Austen?
Right.
So that
would
be,
Well, I really appreciate you coming
Thank
on the
you.
Digital Dialogue. It's been great.
Thanks.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.